So good morning.
Good morning. Please settle down to your spots. So a couple of people asked me about the interview questions, and I will try to pose them today so that you have time to prepare. So I'll do it in the afternoon. All right. So we are discussing special relativity. I showed you basically that it can be derived from Maxwell's theory yesterday, because Maxwell's theory has Lorentz invariance. And you can actually derive this Lorentz, or you can see that the Lorentz invariance is present there. So now, of course, what this means is that you have invariance under Lorentz transformations. The Lorentz transformations are linear transformations of coordinates, where lambda mu nu is a constant matrix here. But it's not an arbitrary constant matrix. It is such that the Minkowski metric element actually remains invariant under it. And that was needed for, for example, the box operator for our wave equation to be the same, to look the same in all coordinate systems. So that can be derived from Maxwell's theory. All right. So you can equivalent write that, this basically, these Lorentz transformations, they leave the space-time interval invariant. So if you measure some distances in your space-time, and you measure some dt and dxi, then you form an element like this, there's a minus dt squared plus dxi dxi, then this will be left invariant under the Lorentz transformations. And that's just expressing that the Minkowski metric will look like minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1 in all frames. All right. So you can also consider the inverse coordinate transformation. Of course, it's a linear transformation. It does have an inverse. And the inverse is unique, right? So if you have matrices, if have A times A minus 1, A times A minus 1 equal to 1, then you can also write, you could write some other matrix A minus 1, A, equal to 1. But of course, for matrices, this A tilde minus 1 is the same as minus A minus 1. This may not be true if you have infinite dimensional space, but for finite dimensional matrices, this is true. So you have only one inverse, right? The left inverse is the same as the right inverse. Okay, and so that's the expression here, how you can write it. Okay, and so once you have this inverse matrix, you can study how various objects actually transform under these Lorentz transformations. If the object does not transform at all, you call the object a scalar. If it does transform, such that the components of the object transform according to lambda, then you will call the object a vector. If it transforms according to lambda tilde, it's called covector. And then, more generally, you can have tensors. There will be some indices here, some indices there, and so on. And you will say that the object is tensor if the components of the tensor transform like this. This index transforms as a vector, this index transforms as a vector, this as a covector, this as a covector. So you will have lots of lambdas. So you have to transform each index separately, independently. You will have lots of lambdas multiplying your original T alpha beta gamma delta. Questions about this? This should be simple. It is simple. OK, very good. So now let's have some fun with these Lorentz transformations. And let me just give you two examples. Which you have seen, I'm sure. So it'll be all, everything will be very trivial. So the Lorentz transformations actually can be split into boosts, which are the new things, which is interesting, and rotations. So the rotation is more familiar to us. Basically, it just takes, it just acts on the spatial coordinates. So lambda alpha beta of rotation. So now if I have coordinates t, x, y, and z, so let's do the rotation in the XY plane, then T, X, Y, and Z. So it does nothing to time, so the time is left completely as a spectator, and it just rotates X and Y. Okay, so then that's done. Okay, so 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and then it rotates according to the standard thing. So it's cosine theta, sine theta, does nothing to Z, and then minus sine theta, theta, sine theta, 0. Okay. So this is how the rotation matrix would look like, how the lambda transformation would look like. And of course, you know, the picture is very simple. So you have the y coordinate, you have the x coordinate, and all it does is just rotates this x by this angle theta. So I have now y prime, x prime, and this is what it does to your frame. And of course, if you draw the orbits, so it leaves the distances invariant, the spatial distances invariant. And so if you draw the orbits of constant things, it is on a circle, right? So if I move the point here, from here to there, and the distance to the origin is preserved. So x squared plus y squared is x prime squared plus y prime squared. And so leave the spatial distances invariant. Super simple, right? So now similarly, you can do the boost. And boost is like a rotation, but now you involve time. And it's almost a rotation, it's a pseudo-rotation. And so what this does is it just rotates the axis here out of the squeeze. T and X axis. Probably double E, right? Like that, maybe. All right, so if I write down this lambda, so lambda alpha beta boost in the TX, so you're boosting in the X direction. And so again, that will be like a rotation, but instead of rotation with this cosine theta, sine theta, whatever, you just have hyperbolic things. So you just cosine H theta, sine H theta, sine H theta, 0, 0, and then minus sine H theta, cosine H theta, 0, and then it does nothing to y and z. Okay, so this is how a boost in the TX direction would look like. Well, the interpretation now, the picture is nicer, well, more interesting maybe. So you start with T and X. Okay, and what this thing does for you is that it squeezes the axis together. So there's a 45 degree line, let's say this is thing. And then, you know, you symmetrically squeeze the axis. So you will have new axis T prime here. And then you will have new axis X prime here. So this is what it does for you. So it's a weird rotation, right? Weird rotation. It's this hyperbolic thing which really screws. And that comes from, you know, the fact that you have this minus, strange minus sign in front of dt square, right? So now if you draw things of, you know, the orbits of what this thing leaves invariant, the orbits are actually hyperbolas. And so one hyperbola would be, for example, like that. Right? So the points on this thing here would remain the same. And then there will be hyperbola like that. And also, now things on this line remain the same. So this will be the orbits. And of course, that's like minus t squared plus x squared is minus t prime squared plus x prime squared. Okay, so this is what's left. What remains the same, and things are on hyperbolas. There'll be another hyperbola here. 45 degrees. Another at the bottom. Right? So in other words, you know, all these points, so if I start here, you know, so then this guy has the same distance as that guy, that guy, that guy, or this guy has the same as this one, this one, this one, and so on. Okay, finally, you may not be happy with cosine h and sine h theta, and in that case, I have for you another representation where you say, well, beta, which in principle is v over c, but for us it's just v, and it's given by tangents h theta. And if you do that, then you find that the cosine h theta is a gamma factor, which is 1 over 1 minus v squared, and then sine h theta is beta gamma, and that's too much. And then your transformation, which is that t prime is, well, from our matrix, t times cosine theta, t times cosine theta, sine h theta, minus x sine h theta, and then x prime is minus sine h theta. And then cosine h theta. Did I make any mistake? Or everything is fine? So then you can write it in more familiar form that this is equal to gamma times t minus vx, and this is equal to gamma times x minus vt. Okay?
T cosine h theta minus x inch theta plus x inch theta?
Sorry, which one? The first line? First line? Okay. It must be plus. Yeah. Plus. Thank you. Why do I have minus there? Did I make a mistake there? Should there be a minus? Probably not. Beta gamma.
It should be a mistake because you need it to be t minus. Or
okay. Exercise, okay? It's an exercise. Very good. So we have, you know, this kind of transformation, and that's really something which was not known before Lorentz and before, you know, Einstein came with this special relativity. Questions?
It's plus on both.
Plus?
It's plus on both.
Yeah.
I think that it is in the transformation, because if we want the determinant to be 1, we need another minus, so that with the other minus.
We need determinant to be 1, that's right. So let's say cosine square theta plus sine h. It's probably minus, yeah.
T plus
vx?
No, but when you take the determinant, you will have it with minus here, so it's okay. This is for sure okay. No, because it goes.
Okay, exercise, okay? If we cannot figure it out in 2 seconds, it's an exercise. Okay, so now you know this transformation has lots of nice physical consequences, and one of them is, for example, the time dilatation. Time And so, of course, you can write down the formula just from these transformations, what's happening. But let me just draw a picture here. Or maybe we shall see. Maybe we'll do both. So let's assume that we have an observer who has a clock. And that observer associates with them the t and x coordinates. And then the observer is looking at the clock, and the clock always clicks and then waits and clicks and waits and clicks and waits. So it clicks here, clicks here, clicks here, clicks here, and so on. So now we have another observer who observes the other observer's clock. Okay. So but that observer is moving with some velocity with respect to the first observer, and so the other observer uses x as t prime and x prime. Okay, so then he sees these clicks in his own t prime. Okay, so he always measures these clicks at x prime equal to 0. Okay, so how he observes these clicks is basically I have to draw parallel lines with the x prime axis. So let's see if I can do that. So this would be parallel to this one. So he would see the click here. Then this would be parallel, not really. So that would see the click here, and so on. All right. So this is the time t prime. Well, let's call this capital T, the period of clicking. And then this would be the period t prime, the period of clicking as observed by the other observer. Is the picture unclear? Should I draw it again? Or is it OK? OK, so now the question is t prime bigger or smaller or equal to t? I have things here. Well, this is t. And that is t prime. Okay. So which one is actually bigger, which one is actually smaller? And to answer that question, you just use the fact that the boost leaves this invariant minus t squared plus x squared really invariant. And so it means that you really the points on the hyperbolas have the same distance. Okay, so if I want to know, what points have the same distance as the t, I just draw this hyperbola. Okay, now I need a different line. Well, it's a hyperbola, twilight hyperbola. Okay, so these are the points of the same distance. But now I see that the hyperbola intersects my t prime axis. So this will be the same t, this thing here. But you see that t prime is bigger than that. So we just proved that t prime is bigger than t. Okay, and so that's why there is a time dilatation. So actually, for observers to move, their time goes more slowly. For moving observers, questions about the picture? Yes. So how you get the clicks on this t prime axis is that you draw parallel lines with x prime, right? Because the observer x prime measures is at x prime equal to 0, right? So I need to draw the lines parallel to my x prime axis. So that's how I get that click and whatever. So it's obvious that this is the distance the moving one observer sees. This is the distance the other observer sees. Which one is bigger? And for that, I need to draw these hyperbolas. OK. So now let's play the same game. Well, of course, the correct expression is that t prime is gamma t, and to derive it is boring, right? You just look at this, and you have t prime, gamma t, and x is equal to 0. So that's it. Okay? So that's boring, but to draw the picture is nice. So second consequence is Lorentz contraction. So again, let me draw a picture. Let's say that we have one observer, T and X, who carries a rod with them. Okay? So there's a rod of the length L. And you know, this rod sweeps this trajectory in the space-time. So it goes from 0 to L. So this is your rod. Okay? And it just fills in this piece. Okay, so this will be again even worse picture. Nobody will be able to see anything in this picture. But anyway, so this is the rod. It's just, you know, stays there. Not, it doesn't move. The length of that rod is L, and this is the trajectory of that rod. So now, very good. So this is L. Now let's see how the other observer sees that rod. What is the length of the other observer perceives? So again, I shouldn't be drawing these. Well, anyway, so this is my t prime, and this is my x prime. So now the other observer measures the rod again at their constant t prime. So the length for the other observer, let's say at, you know, here, will be, you know, this thing here. So this is the length of the rod for the other observer. So this is L prime. This is L prime. Okay? That's obvious. I just look at the rod, take my t equal to t prime equal to constant slice, and measure the rod, and that's L prime. So now the question is L prime bigger than L, or is it smaller, or is it equal? Right? It looks bigger, right? So this looks longer than that. But of course, it's very deceiving because we are in Minkowski space, and so it will not be so. So again, so what you want to do is that you want to draw the hyperbolas where you have, you know, constant interval. And so the hyperbola which starts at L, well, it goes like that. Like that. So this is my hyperbola, where the space-time interval is constant. And then you immediately see is that, you know, this distance is L, this distance is L, this distance is L. You know, the violet thing is L. So now this thing here would be L. And so then you see that L prime is actually smaller than L. And so for moving objects, the distances are shorter. There's a moral to the story. So if you want to, you know, remain young and beautiful, just keep moving. Your time will go more slowly. You will learn in general relativity that if you accelerate or you are close to, you know, objects which gravitate, again, your time goes more slowly. There is a gravitational redshift. And so again, so the best thing is probably keep moving, but close to a black hole, or at least in the library where there's lots of heavy books and stuff like that. So if you just on that out. Okay, so again, you know, the precise expression is L over gamma, and I will leave that up to you to derive this from this thing here. Okay, and it's a little bit less trivial than that, than this one, but still trivial, still one line. Okay, so I'll leave that to you. Okay, so now there's lots of paradoxes in special relativity, paradox of twins, paradox of something else, paradox of accelerating rockets, which is not really special relativity, and so on. You will discuss the paradox of twins in tutorial tomorrow. Okay, so the moral of the story again is you can sleep well at night. There's really no paradoxes in special relativity. Everything is self-consistent. And so just people, you know, formulating, disproving special relativity is always like not understanding what's going on. But you know, physics is consistent and special relativity. There's no paradox. Questions? Okay. So we had fun with Lorentz transformations. Let me discuss motion of relativistic particles. So this is our T and X. And then the particle sweeps out a trajectory in our space-time T and X. So this will be a trajectory of the particle. If you're a mathematician, you would call this gamma of some lambda. We will just call it X mu of lambda. So you know, knowing what T and X is for, so there's a parameter lambda parameterizing this, this curve. And then knowing, you know, t and x for each lambda gives us the trajectory for the particle. So this lambda is a parameter parametrizing our trajectory. Okay. You can also define the four velocity, which will be like a tangent curve. So there'll be u mu. Tx mu over d lambda. It's a tangent curve to each point of the trajectory. So now the catch is that if you want to redescribe physical objects, you cannot draw any trajectory in the space-time, as we discussed yesterday. You have to basically keep moving forward in this light cone. Okay, and so that's a restriction which comes from who knows where. But you know, the massive particles move on time-like trajectories. Which means that wherever you draw the light cone, and you have the future and you have the past, the light cone, well, this should be really 45 degrees. It doesn't look like that anyway. So wherever you draw the light cone here, the particle always, at each point, has to move forward to the future in that light cone. It's not possible suddenly your trajectory will make turn like that and you know then return back, because here, you would be going outside of the light cone. You would be going space-like, okay? Massive particles on time-like trajectories. Massless particles move on null trajectories. Null or light-like trajectories. That means that I always have to travel on that surface of the light cone, okay? And so that's the restrictions which come from. Okay. Very good. So Questions? This is boring, isn't it? All right. But I have to do it, otherwise Luis will be happy if I haven't covered this. Okay. So what you can do is that you can reparametrize your parameter lambda. And you can choose a nice parametrization, and the parametrization is for massive particles by proper time. Okay. Nice parameter. For massive particles, is proper time. And proper time is defined through this. It's d tau. It's basically minus the line element of Minkowski space. So if you take your metric ds square is minus dt square plus dxi square, and then you take minus of that, and then proper time meaning like time measured by an observer, you know, well, his own clock, so he's not moving in there. So that would be that d tau square. So what I'm saying is here's this thing here. So d tau square is minus dt square plus dxi, dxi. So d tau, is square root of minus eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay. So that's obviously Lorentz invariant. The proper time of an observer is always the same. Doesn't matter what the motion of other observers is. It's just his proper time, and so that's why nothing changes, right? Notice a nice thing is that I can divide by anything here. D lambda here, D lambda here. And I multiply by D lambda here, and it's still the same thing. And if you change lambda to anything else, to lambda prime, it will still look the same. So this thing is reparametrization invariant. In the same way as we had the free particle written in terms of arbitrary clock, that was reparametrization invariant. I could change g to t prime and nothing changed. So this is reparametrization invariant. I can parametrize by any parameter lambda, and d tau remains the same. And of course, the action for the free particle will be just integral over d tau. Okay? So our action will be reparametrization invariant. It will be a totally constrained system. The corresponding Hamiltonian will be equal to zero, and so on. Right? We already know the story. Okay. So let me choose. So this is reparametrization invariance. So let's choose lambda equal to t, which is the coordinate time. Well, if you choose lambda equal to t, then d tau is so. Minus eta mu nu dx mu over dt dx nu over dt dt. But the x mu coordinates are t and xi, right? And eta mu nu is just minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 on the diagonal. So when I do dt over dt is 1, dt over dt is 1, so that'll be minus. Will be plus 1, and then plus or minus, because of this minus here, dxi over dt square dt. And then we define gamma to be, so this thing here is just the standard velocity as we know it. So this is v. So this is 1 minus v square dt, which is dt over gamma, where the gamma is whatever we defined before over there. Questions? Boring, isn't it?
So when you wrote the boost, I think you made a mistake and Raquel was right. That is minus sinh.
Okay, I'm happy to correct it. So it's cosine square minus plus sine square.
Both of them.
It's probably one, yes. Yeah. I think so.
And the determinant is one.
Yeah. Determinant has to be equal to one. Okay. Well, because you consider proper Lorentz transformations, you consider improper, you would involve like time inversion or parity transformation and so on. So those would have determinant not necessarily to one, but yeah.
Sorry, but could you explain how the t prime is determined?
How the t prime here? Oh, you mean this formula here? Oh, in the picture. So the t is, I just keep clicking on x equal to 0 with some period t, right? So then the question is, how is this that scene for the observer who is moving, right? And so for that, I need to draw the lines which are parallel with the x prime axis because he measures these things at x prime equal to 0. So I draw parallel lines with the x prime axis. I see this click, this click, this. What about L prime? OK, so L prime. So this is the trajectory I sweep for my rod. So the rod fills this thing here, right? And then both observers measure, when they do the measurement, they better fix their time, right? So this observer fixes the t equal to 0 or t equal to 1 or whatever. It still measures L, so this is L. The prime observer fixes their prime, t prime equal to 0. So it will be here, or parallel line with that, or parallel line with that, and so on. So he could measure at any t prime, right? But t prime is constant. Yeah. Keep asking questions. Finally, you will see that I will not be able to answer. OK, so we have now the proper for velocity. So we already defined the for velocity over there, u mu dx mu over d lambda. That will be the for velocity with respect to the parameter lambda. But if you define it with respect to the proper time, then that's called proper velocity, proper for velocity. So u mu dx mu over d tau, that's a special choice of this velocity if you want. OK, but of course, I can write it in terms of the coordinate things, dx mu over dt, dt over d tau. Why not? And then this thing here, we already calculated, is 1 and v. And dt over d tau, we derived over there, is gamma. So this is equal to gamma 1 and v. You can check that with this, once you have proper for velocity, then u square is equal to minus 1. Okay? You can also define for momentum. E mu. M0 u mu, where this is the rest mass. So which means a mass measured in the rest frame of the particle. And so then you form another. So this is a scalar. M0 is a scalar. Times vector is another vector. So this is a vector. And then plugging whatever we derived over here Well, it's just M0 gamma, and then M0 gamma and V. I should have kept C here, but anyway, M0 gamma. So now if you define, well, this is the rest mass. Now if you define the normal mass, which is like affected by the motion of the thing, okay? So if you just say this is mass, and of course if you are not moving, then gamma is just equal to 1, v is equal to 0, so gamma equal to 1. So the mass will reduce to the rest mass in your rest frame. But you know, this is how it is affected by your motion. So then this is just m. And then you have m0 gamma here as well, so it's mv. Okay, and so I'll write this thing here, E and P. Okay, so here I am using two things. So mv is P, we know that. That's the momentum. So the four momentum is the three momentum. But then the fact that m equals to E or mc squared equals to E, you will derive in your tutorial today, I think. Okay, so here we are using the fact that E equals to mc squared or in m as provided by Einstein. And you will derive it following his steps, actually. See tutorial. Two-page paper, right? All right, so we have that. So now, just for fun, let's calculate what P mu square is. So let's calculate P square, which is P mu. Well, if I lower the index, I just pick up a minus sign in front of E. So this will be equal to minus E square plus P square. Right? On the other hand, this quantity here is a Lorentz scalar. I can calculate it in any frame I want, and it will remain the same. So if I calculate it in the rest frame of the particle, there won't be any momentum, and my mass will be just m0 square. So this is equal to minus m0 square. Okay, calculating in the rest frame. Calculate in rest frame. And so we have a beautiful formula for the energy. If I can put it on the right side. Well, okay, so the energy will be m square plus p square, square root of that. So it's p square plus m0 square. You can put m0 out of this. And then you will have 1 plus P over M0 square. You can consider the small velocity, small momenta, and so on. And so this will be this thing here, will be 1 plus 1 half P over M0 square plus other terms. And you see that your energy is equal to m0 plus p square over 2 m0 plus other things. Okay, that's your energy. And so the energy has some constant energy, some constant contribution, which is the rest mass. So this is the rest energy, or rest mass, rest energy. And this is your kinetic energy of the first order kinetic energy as we know it, for non-relativistic particles, and then you will have relativistic corrections here. Okay, so basically, special relativity gives you some rest energy. Of course, in classical physics, well, if you don't have gravity, you don't care about rest energy, right? You can always set, you know, zero energy level to be equal to anything. But you know, once things start gravitating, actually, any energy will provide gravitational field, and so that's the cosmological constant problem, right? So if you have some energy of fluctuating fields of quantum field theory, you know, in quantum field theory, and you know, they should have, well, they have some energy, so they should be gravitating, and so you get a mismatch between what is actually expected for the fluctuations of quantum fields and what is actually measured for this rest energy for the cosmological constant. Okay. Questions? Yes.
The gamma over there, so the v is basically the speed in that frame, and gamma is defined with respect to the velocity of that frame relative to the velocity of proper time frame, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Gamma is not 1 minus v squared, it's some 1 minus some different speed squared.
If you have, you know, this four velocity, then this four velocity will have some component in the time direction, and it will have some component in the space direction. And so if you go to the rest frame, yeah, so what you said is correct. So it's a basically measure the velocity with respect to the rest frame or whatever of the particle. All right. By the way, this thing here also applies to massless particles. And so you will have all the massless particles equal to P for massless particles. So photons will have energy equal to the magnitude of the momentum. Okay. So that's nice. So now let's do started with Lagrangian picture, so let's just write down the Lagrangian for free motion, for geodesic motion in flat space. Okay, so the motion of a free particle with no external forces is derived. From the following action, it has to be Lorentz invariant. The only Lorentz invariant quantity which you can think about the particle. Well, okay, not the only one, but you have u square equals to 1. Minus 1, so that's invariant. You can include it in the action, doesn't help you. But basically, the action will be function of u squared. Okay? But the certainly invariant quantity is just the proper time. Okay? So if you write an action which would be just integral over d tau, then that's a Lorentz invariant quantity which characterizes your particle. Now to have the proper units of energy, you just put minus is convention, and you put, action is energy times time. So we have energy here and time here. Okay. And so we can write it in terms of your arbitrary parameter lambda, if you want, minus m0 integral of minus eta mu nu dx mu d lambda, dx nu, d lambda, d lambda. Okay? And so this will be our Lagrangian, which is a function of x mu and x mu dot, which is dx mu over d lambda. that cannot be anything else. Yes?
What is the action for massless particles?
Okay. We will get to that, maybe. Wait, maybe is your question for maybe 20 minutes. If you get there, we could get there. If not, I will tell you. Okay? So obviously, if we set M0 equal to 0, then we wouldn't have much of an action for massless particles, right? Anyway, so that's the action. So let's derive the corresponding equation of motion. So now our Euler Lagrange equations, just dl over dx mu minus d over d lambda, dl over dx dot mu equals to 0. Okay. Now, if you can help me, what is dl over dx mu? And 0, right? Eta mu is just a constant. It's plus 1, minus 1, minus 1. So there is no x mu anywhere in this Lagrangian here. So this is equal to 0 minus d over d lambda. What is dl over d x d mu? That's complicated. What is that?
Are we saying like lambda is our proper or it's a time, or is the dot with respect? Oh yeah. That is our time, right?
So here lambda is an arbitrary parameter, right? We started saying, well, we can parameterize our trajectory of the particle by anything, by arbitrary lambda. Of course, you're right. It will be in the end useful to say, well, actually, we are choosing lambda equal to proper time.
You are doing dd lambda over there, and usually you do dd.
Yeah. So now, you know, in terms of proper time, the action looks like this, okay? So then, you know, this is not very helpful to derive equations of motion. So instead, you write it in terms of arbitrary parameter, and then in the end, you fix your parameter to be equal to tau,
yeah.
Okay? So now I write it in terms of lambda, so there's like dx mu over d lambda, dx mu over d lambda here. So now my Lagrangian, which is, you know, this square root here, it's just a function of x mu and dx mu over d lambda.
Oh yeah, you did right.
Right, so this is my velocity, that's my position, right? And so this is my equation, right? So I'm still using this time to be the time parametrizing my trajectory here.
Yeah, I just forgot x dot was that.
Yeah, okay, great. More questions? All right, so now if I differentiate this guy here, well, I get 1 half, 1 over square root of that. And then I have to differentiate what is inside. And what is inside is minus 2 eta mu nu, and then x dot nu. And the other one, x dot mu, I just kill by doing this thing here. And that's it. So this is equal to 0. Multiply by that, it's not minus. Okay, so then bother, I have to do two terms. So minus minus 2 is gone, so I differentiate two terms. I differentiate this thing here, 1 over square root, and I differentiate x dot nu. So very good. So I have d over d lambda of 1 over square root eta mu nu, and then I leave this thing here as it were, and then I have 1 over square root eta mu nu x double dot mu equals to 0. Okay. So now, when you were learning calculus, they always told you, okay, differentiate first and then pluck the value, whatever you need to pluck, okay? Here I'm telling you, let's do the opposite. You know, violating all calculus whatsoever. Let's pluck now lambda equals to tau. If we do that, then we know that the four velocity u square is equals to minus 1. Okay, But if you look at what this thing here is, oh, it's minus u square. It's 1. So the square root is actually 1. Okay? So here, this is 1. This is also 1. So this term cannot contribute. Okay? So this term is 0. And then this is 1. So we just get an equation x double dot nu equals to 0. Okay? And that's the right result. Of course, I cheated. You never are supposed to do this, right? You're always supposed to differentiate first and then plug lambda equal to tau, and you will see that you get the same result. Okay? So just do the differentiation if you don't believe me. So this is an example of how, you know, doing wrong thing gives you the right answer. No, please do it correctly, okay? But this is the right result, x double dot nu equals to 0. The first term goes to 0, and the second term, and then the square root is just 1. If I do this, u square is minus 1, then square root is just 1. And I can throw away a term nu, and I'm getting x double dot nu equals to 0. Okay, that's good. So that's our geodesic equation, if you want. It's a motion of free particle in empty space, right? So that's a geodesic equation. In flat space. Okay. Of course, I can write it in terms of the four velocity as well. So we know. So now, you know, this double dot now is with respect to the proper time. Okay? Okay. So now here, the dot is actually d over d tau. So we started as a dot, which was d over d lambda. We end up with the dot, which is d over d tau. Okay, so you can write it equally as, you know, d of u nu over d tau equals to 0. That's the same thing. We know that u nu is just d x nu over d tau. So this is the same thing. But you can also write it as, well, the four velocity is in some sense function of x. So you can also write it. You can write d over d tau as d over d tau is dx nu over d tau d over dx nu. Just doing this thing here. This is a four velocity. You knew. So you can rewrite your geodesic equation as using, you know, this d over d tau on this first part here. So this will be equal to u nu d over dx nu of, okay, that's not good, u mu dx mu u nu. I just changed the dummy variable, the variable which, well, the index I'm summing over. Okay. And so sometimes people write as d u of u nu. I'm doing a derivative. I'm doing a gradient. This is a u mu gradient mu of u nu. I'm doing a gradient here. And it's projected along the direction u mu, so I'm doing a directional derivative on u nu, and that's equal to 0. Okay. On purpose, I did write the gradient with the nabla thing here, and so this will be true in general relativity as well. So this is your geodesic equation, even in curved space, whereas for us, the nabla mu is just simply the partial derivative. right? It's just that this partial derivative d over dx mu, in general relativity, there'll be some inertial forces contributing to this, which come from the change of coordinates or from true gravitational forces. Okay, but anyway, so this is a geodesic equation. Now we know it in general relativity as well. Questions? Okay, so that's for the free particle. Free particle, of course, is in flat space, so it'll just be straight lines, right? So if you solve this thing here, you get at most linear solution, so it will be straight lines. But of course, in general relativity, the straight line is not necessarily be straight. And so you have, for example, the motion of Mercury or motion of Earth around Sun is a straight line. We all know it's an ellipse, but that ellipse is actually a straight line in terms of this equation here. Okay, so that's what you will see. So now if you have true forces, if particle not free, then we have to put the force on the left-hand side. So we'll have F mu is the force. And you cannot see here, probably. And this will be the M0 d u mu over d tau. So that will be your Newton's law, if you want. Or you can write it as dp mu over d tau, provided, well, OK. What is also always true is that f mu is dp mu over d tau. That's always true, where p mu is whatever the form momentum which we derived. If the rest mass is not changing, then you can also write it in this way. Okay, it's the same thing in Newtonian physics, right? If the mass is not changing, I can always write dp over dt as m times du over dt, right? But only when the rest mass is not changing. So if you have something which radiates away some energy or whatever, then the middle one will not be true, right? So this is more general. Okay, and of course the prototype of a four force in special relativity is the electromagnetic force, right? So example would be F mu equals to E times F mu nu, U nu, as we saw yesterday. So the Lorentz force would be a prototype of a nice force, four force in special relativity. Okay, questions? Very good. So now we still have 20 minutes. We've done particles. We understand general relativity. Let's go to string theory, OK? Let's understand string. String theory, we have more dimensional objects. So in general relativity or in special relativity, you just have particles. Particles are simple. They are point-like. They sweep out the trajectories in the space-time. However, you can also include some higher dimensional objects. You can have a string. And the string, this is your string, and you move it in the space-time. And as you move it in the space-time, it sweeps out not a trajectory, but rather a sheet, right? So it has a worksheet and stuff like that. So in string theory, we have high-dimensional objects. So particle is zero-dimensional. string would be one dimensional, whatever higher dimensional objects, such as strings, we can have membranes or whatever, but and so on. But in general, these objects are called p-branes. Branes. So p stands for the dimensionality of the object. Okay. So particle is a zero brane. Particle is a zero brane. String would be a one brane. One dimensional object, one spatial dimension, and so on, right? And then you have two brains, three brains, five brains, whatever, right? So now we already know what the particle is doing. It just speeds up the trajectory and the space-time, right? So this is the particle. It's a trajectory in space-time, so it sweeps out a line. Okay, that line is sometimes called world line because it's like, you know, what that particle leaves in the world is the trajectory it has. That's world line. Okay, and this word line is simply describe whatever I was just doing by doing x mu of some parameter lambda, right? So if I know coordinates x mu of lambda, then I know how the particle moves in the space time. So similarly, if you consider a string, well, string is a one-dimensional object. So this is your t and x. And you know, at you know, this is how your trajectory looks like, let's say, at given time. Well, I'm suppressing some dimensions, right? So I can have curved string or whatever. But of course, at equal to constant, it will be just like, well, anyway, so this is my string at a given time. And then, you know, this end sweeps this trajectory, this end sweeps that trajectory. And so this would be the strings later on, you know, at some later time. So now this doesn't look like a line. This looks like world, but it doesn't look like a line. It looks like sheet. That's why it's called world sheet, okay? World sheet. So if you have taken some courses on differential geometry or whatever, you know that you would describe some surfaces. You can describe them by embedding in high dimensional space, but it's still a two-dimensional object, right? So intuitively, I know that here I can only go along the direction lambda, right? So if I'm somewhere here, I could go along the direction of lambda. But I can also go along the other direction, along the spatial direction. So there will be some other coordinate, sigma, and which tells me, you know, I can go here and I can go there. So really, your word sheet will be described by two coordinates. It will be described by lambda and sigma. There will be two coordinates. So you have two-dimensional space now, right? And so this word sheet is described by embedding, where you say, well, for given lambda and sigma, I have some coordinates on that word sheet, right? So this is your lambda and sigma. So if you specify how, you know, the surface looks like in that high-dimensional space in terms of your inner coordinates lambda and sigma, that's, you basically describe how the sheet looks like in our space, right? So it's now instead of just using one coordinate, I have two-dimensional things, so I have to use two coordinates. So this describes the worksheet. Okay. Or more generally, so let's call this Xi A, where A, well, which is, you know, lambda and sigma. So A goes from, you know, 0 to 1. Takes the value 0 and 1. It's lambda is 0 and sigma is 1. So now you see that it's super simple to do it for general p-brain, right? It just will be for general p-brain. Now you will have many more dimensions. You'll still have lambda, but then you have sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, and so on to sigma p. Right? So general p-brain simply described by, you know, this embedding. This embedding depends on the, you know, inner coordinates, where the index a goes from 1 to p. Right? And so the psi a would be lambda, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma p. Okay? Okay, so questions? We now know how to describe them. So what is the motion of these p-brains in the space-time, right? So what is the motion of the particle? So the motion of the particle is given by the reduction over here, which is still somewhere here. So what we are really doing is that we are extremizing proper time. Okay, we are taking maximum proper time or something like that, so that, you know, and that gives us the motion, okay? So if you have, you know, free particle, we extremize the proper time. In other words, we extremize, of course, the proper time so somehow characterizes, like, you know, getting from here to there. What is the length of this path or something like that, right? So we extremize the length. Of this trajectory. Okay, so similarly, you might guess that the motion of the string will be given by extremizing the surface area of the worksheet. Okay, so typically you would think, well, I want to minimize the surface area, I want to minimize the length or something like that. In special relativity, it's maximizing the proper time. Here it's maximizing whatever the worksheet area. Okay, so by the way, if you have,
sorry, I don't understand why you were extremizing the length. You were extremizing,
okay, it would be length if
you were extremizing the action,
the proper time. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Let's put this in many of these things here. Okay. If you had a spatial geodesic, right? If I had a geodesic which would go from here to there, but there was no motion whatsoever, you would be really taking the minimum of the length of that spatial geodesic. Now you are taking the minimum of the length, but in, you know, the Minkowski thing. So you are taking the minimum, which now is in the time direction. Extremum in the time direction. Extremum in the time direction. So that's why it's like proper time.
What?
So it's like really taking extremum of the length, but now in the space-time picture, right? If it's a spatial picture, it's really extremum of the length of the spatial geodesic. Okay. By the way, if you know, for string, it's called worksheet because we have a sheet, really like a sheet of paper. So now this thing here, of course, has more spatial dimensions, so it's called world volume. Okay. So now, for you know, the motion of p-brains corresponds to extremizing a volume of war volume. Okay, so more volume is a generalization of the worksheet into more dimensions, and you want to extremize the volume of that more volume. Okay. Okay, so that's what it is, and you can just write down the action, and the action, I'll write it down. It's called Nambu Goto action, and it better reduce to our action in the limit of zero brain for particles. Okay, and so this thing here. Basically, what you have to do is that you have to write down what the volume of the word volume is. That will be your action. And then once you have that, you just extremize that. And you get corresponding equations of motion. So now, this is given by the Nambu Goto action. I'll write it down and then, okay, whatever. So, Nambu Goto. There must be some tension, but it's not important. So let's just put what is really, you know, thing that you have to vary, and it's super simple. We had square root. We have to have square root again. Okay. We had a square root of number. You can square root. You can take square root of number. You cannot take square root of something, right? So it has to be a number. So the only way how you can get a number, if you have some matrices, is that you take the trace of that matrix, or you take the determinant of that matrix and stuff like that. In our case, it's the determinant. Okay, so it will be minus determinant of some matrix gamma AB, and then we have P plus 1 coordinates xi, which we integrate over. Okay, so there's some matrix here. This matrix better measure somehow the volume on that listing, better measures the volume on that word volume, right? And so the gamma AB, he is given by our embedding divided by xiA, our embedding divided by xiB, and then the metric which we have in our spacetime is the Minkowski spacetime. So these are the coordinates in the Minkowski spacetime. This is our Minkowski spacetime. And then we just differentiate with respect to the x mu is a function of xi, and so this is it, and this is called induced metric. Metric on the word volume. And it really measures, you know, the distances on that word volume. If you take determinant of that and take square root of that, that measures the volume. Okay? You will see that in relativity, that the volume of the spacetime is just given minus by square root of minus that g. Right? And so that's you may be familiar with. So this is nothing else, except that the gamma AB now is a metric on that word volume. Okay, and we're done. So this is string theory. You've just solved it. Okay, not quite. Well, okay, good. So we have that. And indeed, this is a motion of p brains and everything, three p brains. Okay, so then you can start coupling these p brains to some other fields, electromagnetism, right? You will have generalization of the Lorentz force, and so on. Okay. Okay. 5 minutes. Massless particles and string theory. Massless strings. Okay. So now, what we have seen here, well, is that these actions are quite nasty. Okay. So Nambu Goto, or even the point particle action, is quite nasty. And why is it nasty? So these actions, meaning for, by the way, if you take a particle, right? Then, well, there's only one psi, which is the lambda. So then we have dx mu over d lambda, dx mu over d lambda, eta mu nu. That is a scalar. Determinant of a scalar is a scalar. So this is just minus eta mu nu dx mu over d lambda, dx mu over d lambda, and we recover whatever we had before. Right? So it definitely reduces the point particle in the limit of just zero brain. Okay. Very good. So now these actions are simple, but not nice. Well, whatever that means. What I mean by that is that you have a square root. You don't like square roots, okay? So if you want to quantize things, you know that you can only quantize harmonic oscillators. So you need something quadratic to quantize. The action is just whatever, harmonic oscillator. But suddenly you are getting an action which is square root of something, right? So you don't want that. You want to transform this into something which is quadratic. Okay, so there's problems with square root. This is the square root. But also, as noticed, David, is that, did I pronounce correctly, David? Yeah, okay. Is that you know, that action is not well defined if you have m0 goes to 0. Problems with m0 goes to 0. Okay, so we have these two problems, and both these problems are solved by an alternative type of action which is called Polyakov action. You open string theory book, you will see Polyakov action staring at you. So instead, consider Polyakov action. Let me do it first for the particle, and you will study it in your tutorial, so don't worry, you will see it a little bit more. So instead of writing the action like that, as this m0 d tau, whatever this thing here, you write a different action. You write Polyakov action. And that will be given by 1 half integral 1 over e eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda minus m0 e square d lambda. Okay, so this would be the point particle Polyakov action. So now you see that we still have x mu as a function of lambda. We now have m0 not standing in front of the whole thing, but rather only in one term here. But we have another field here. So we have the fields now are x mu of lambda. But there is yet another field, e of lambda. Okay. So we have two fields now, x mu of lambda and e of lambda. So e is here and e is there. Okay. But you see that the field e is strange field. There is no derivatives of that field. But what E is really is a Lagrange multiplier. Okay? So there's no, it's not dynamical field, it's just a Lagrange multiplier. It's a constraint if you want. And you can eliminate that constraint at some point. Or you can even eliminate it at the action. So better when we eliminate the constraint, we get back from this action to that action. If that happens, the two actions are equivalent. Okay? So let's do it. Of course, how will you eliminate the constraint? Is that you write down the equations of motion for that field, right? So writing down, so varying with respect to E, if you do delta E, well, okay, it's 1 minus E squared, delta E, and then whatever, eta mu nu, dx mu, d lambda, dx nu, d lambda, minus 2e. This is a disaster. Am I doing something wrong? There must be just E. Sorry, it's just E. It's good that I varied it, because otherwise, just E. So it's 2, it's minus M0. Is equal to 0 is the corresponding equation. I just vary with respect to E. This is what I get. And so you see that you can solve E as 1 over M0 square root of minus 8 mu nu dx mu d lambda dx mu d lambda. So this is basically a constraint that E has to be equal to that. Okay, you're getting it as a consequence of Euler-Lagrange equation for E or this thing, but of course Euler-Lagrange equation is trivial because E is not dynamical, it's a constraint. So now if you plug back to SP, plug back to SP, then you get your favorite action, d tau action. Okay. So what it means is that, you know, the two actions are equivalent. I just introduce an extra field, right? That extra field is just a Lagrange multiplier. I can always eliminate it back again, and I can always get back to my action, which is over there. Okay.
Why can't we just use the first part? Like, why do we need to use the square root of minus? Like, we can use d tau to like power 2. It's also a scaling variant quantity. It can be our action. Why do we need the square root at all? This is my action.
I mean, you cannot have d tau square, right? So that would be a strange integral to do. But the truth is, what really this is writing here, I mean, when we expand it, is you're writing s as a function of u square, right? Of four velocity square. That's what you are writing, in fact. So dx mu over d lambda is a four velocity, right? And so whatever this thing is u square. So now we are taking the action to be square root of u square. Okay, so that's our choice. Well, that's our choice. Okay, so that's the that's the standard action. Okay, but you are right. In principle, you can take any function of u square; it will still give you the Jersey equations. Okay, and so you are right. In principle, you could take that, and we'll be doing it here. Don't worry, we are just doing it. Okay, okay. So wait. So you know you can put it back, this solution here. You plug it there, and you get back to that action. So the actions are classically equivalent. Quantum mechanically, this action is much nicer because it's just some velocity square, right? So this is your favorite harmonic oscillator, which you know how to quantize and so on. So this action is the right start quantizing point. Okay, but there's another advantage at the classical level, and the advantage is, well, the appearance of M0 is only in the second term. Okay, so now I can set M0 goes to 0. Okay, I kill the other term, but the first term still remains. And this is your action for massless particles. Okay, so.
Don't we have a problem in that E is inversely proportional on M? So if M goes to 0, E goes to infinity, so the first term would also go to 0?
You should first find the equations of motion and then set E to 0.
Yeah. So now. So this is, you know, classical equivalent. Now I can take M0 goes to 0. We just get an action, which is the first term here. So we have 1 over E d lambda eta mu nu dx mu dx nu d lambda d lambda. But 1 over E is just function of lambda. So I can define nu lambda. I can define d lambda tilde to be d lambda. Well, this is not right. Let's not do it. I can rescale lambda, absorb E into d lambda, and I will just have my action for massless particles as massless particles would be, well, 1/2, not interesting, eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda d lambda. And so this would be your action for massless particles. It's a action of u square again. And that has no problems with taking m0. Well, this is for m0 equal to 0.
But m0 is absorbed into the lambda. So there's still, like, taking m0 to 0 stuff problems, right? Like, we're just absorbing the infinitude into the lambda.
OK, very good. So what, what you just observed, that I could use that action for massless particles as well. And that's true. The geodesic equation for massless particles and massless particles is the same. So you know, you're right. You could have done that.
So what you could have done from the start was to just say, okay, variating that and setting that equal to zero is basically equivalent to that to the power of two, and don't have the square root, and also absorb the m naught into the lambda, and you get the exact same result.
I agree. This is the standard way to do. This is the standard argument, and this is the nice action to consider. Okay. So this is a nice action because it's quadratic in your variables. Okay.
The square root of that, the square root of that is also quadratic, isn't it? Just to say that, just to write the action from the start as minus m naught the integral of eta mu nu.
Yeah. You could have done that. Yes. Yes. And we have just derived it here. No. You could have done that.
Maybe I'm missing something, but for a massless particle, it would just move on a null trajectory. So then the e to mu nu, the x mu d lambda, the x mu d lambda would be zero.
Uh huh.
So.
Yes. So who cares, right? The action is zero on shell. That's fine, right? You will see that in Einstein gravity, the action is zero on shell. Who cares, right? the value of the action not important here, right? So it will be zero only once you know what true motion is. Right, and it's a feature of many theories, right?
Is the non-Poincaré action is for massless p?
So this one here. No, it's for massive. It's like that one, right? So there will be some mass or tension or whatever standing in front of it. Last thing I want to write down so that our string theory picture is complete. So we wrote the Polyakov action for this thing here. So now the Polyakov action for strings is just d square xi, square root of h, well, let's call it e, e a b. Now I'm doing something, e a b, gamma a b. So that's the action for strings. So now gamma a b is our favorite induced metric here. Okay, so that's this thing here. This E here is a determinant here. E. So this E is like that E over there. It's an auxiliary variable. There is no dynamics in this. It's just an auxiliary field, which you can vary with respect to that. We see that we are missing this term over here, meaning that the strings are massless. So we are considering, you know, the theory of massless strings. But now, if you look at that, the gamma AB is just a quadratic quantity in x mu psi A. It's like, well, this thing here, you can really think about it like lambda x mu square, right? So that's what it is. Yeah, I'm taking a derivative of x mu with respect to the coordinate xi A, squaring that, and that's it. So if you look at this action here, well, maybe you've seen an action where you have lambda phi square, right? So that would be a theory of massless scalars, right? So if you write down action 1/2 nabla phi square, you have massless scalars, means that you have 4, in string theory actually 10, massless scalars living in the two-dimensional worksheet, okay? And that's your string theory action. So let me stop. That's the whole string theory you will need.
I don't really understand the motivation behind introducing a new field. And this new field E, so we could just from the start write the Polyakov action and all of the action in terms of the previous fields that we have. Why do we need to introduce E?
Well, it gives you extra freedom, right? It gives you extra freedom. So I can fix the E to be equal to that, and then I'm back, or I can gauge fix E to be something else, right? So it's
freedom is not useful all the time.
But it will be useful in string theory.
Okay, but so physical. specific.
It's like an auxiliary metric. I don't know. It's yeah. You will soon fix it to something, right? But here I can fix it to be equal to that, and I'm back to the action. Or I can just keep it in the action and see how far I get with that action, right? You just introduce extra fields so that your action has some nice properties.
Action is not unique. Like, how do you know that introducing two fields is a useful thing? Or I can introduce like 100 fields until.
Well, you know that because people tried this action and they didn't get very far, right? Similarly, you can try this action and it's nice to derive equations of motion and so on. But if you want to quantize it, you don't get very far. Okay, so this action is better for quantizing, for example. Right? One last thing which I didn't say, you have muscle scalar fields living in two dimensions on the worksheet. Scalar field theory is conformal in two dimensions. Okay, so your string theory will be a conformal field theory. And if you demand that the conformal symmetry is preserved at the quantum level, you derive Einstein equations from string theory. Okay, so string theory will contain gravity, and it is a theory of quantum gravity. It may not be the theory of quantum gravity. It is a theory. Okay?